Thank you for being an amazing supporter of the 10X Podcast Group, home to the history of the Caribbeans. We're excited to have you as a valued member of our growing community. If you haven't already, we'd love for you to follow us on your favorite podcast platform. Your likes, comments, and reviews mean so much to us. They help us reach a wider audience and inspire us to keep sharing these incredible stories. With new episodes released daily, your feedback plays a crucial role in shaping our content and making it even better. Your dedication and enthusiasm drive our mission to document and celebrate the rich history of the Caribbean. We're deeply grateful for your support. Today, we're thrilled to present St. Bart's Episode 2, a captivating story tracing the journey from the island's earliest settlers to the present day. So sit back, relax, and join us as we guide you through this fascinating chapter in Caribbean history. Enjoy the journey. Chapter 5, A Swedish Kingdom in the Caribbean, 1784 to 1878. The waves lapped against the rocky shores of St. Bart's as they had for centuries, whispering secrets to the wind, carrying the echoes of battles fought and lives endured. But on a fateful day in 1784, something changed. A ship, unlike any that had come before, anchored in the island's bay. It bore a flag foreign to the Caribbean, a blue field adorned with a golden cross, the banner of Sweden. St. Bart's, long a forgotten fragment of the French Caribbean, had just been sold to the Kingdom of Sweden. What followed was one of the most remarkable and often overlooked chapters in Caribbean history. The transformation of this small, rugged island into a Swedish trading hub, an experiment in free commerce, and an unlikely European outpost in the tropics. The deal that changed everything, 1784. The year was 1784, and France was desperate for money. The American Revolutionary War had drained its treasury, and the looming financial crisis threatened to destabilize the kingdom. At the same time, Sweden, one of Europe's quieter powers, sought to expand its global influence, hoping to carve out a niche in the lucrative Caribbean trade. In an unexpected negotiation, King Gustav III of Sweden struck a deal with King Louis XVI of France. France would cede St. Bart's to Sweden in exchange for trading privileges in the Swedish port of Gothenburg. At first glance, it seemed like an odd acquisition. Sweden had no major Caribbean colonies, no fleets of sugar-producing plantations, and no clear strategic reason to claim a remote island with little agricultural value. But King Gustav III had a vision. Instead of turning St. Bart's into a plantation economy like its neighbors, Sweden declared it a free port, a place where merchants from any nation could trade without restriction or taxation. And just like that, this small island, once an afterthought in European colonial plans, became one of the most important smuggling and trading centers in the Caribbean. The birth of Gustavia, a Swedish city in the tropics. The first act of Swedish rule was renaming the capital. The settlement formerly known as Carinage was rechristened Gustavia, in honor of the Swedish king. Almost overnight, the island was transformed. Swedish administrators, merchants, and engineers arrived, eager to reshape St. Bart's into a functioning trade hub. They built warehouses, docks, and trading houses, all designed to facilitate commerce. Unlike the lavish colonial cities of Havana or Santo Domingo, Gustavia had a distinctly Swedish character, practical, efficient, and built to withstand the elements. Stone buildings replaced thatched huts, streets were paved, and the first European-style fortifications were erected. By the 1790s, St. Bart's had become a bustling hub of trade. Ships from France, England, Spain, the Netherlands, and the United States all passed through its harbor, eager to take advantage of its duty-free status. Swedish neutrality in global conflicts also meant that traders from warring nations could do business here without fear of seizure. It was a golden age of commerce, and for the first time, St. Bart's was thriving. The slave trade and the dark side of prosperity, 1785 to 1813. While St. Bart's never became a major plantation colony, the Swedish administration quickly realized that slave labor was still a crucial part of Caribbean trade. In 1785, Sweden established a slave market in Gustavia, where African men, women, and children were bought and sold to merchants from other islands. Unlike the vast plantations of St. Domingue or Jamaica, St. Bart's was never a major center of enslaved labor, but it became a key transit point for the Caribbean slave trade. Sweden, a nation that prided itself on Enlightenment ideals, found itself deeply entangled in the moral contradictions of empire. Some Swedish officials spoke against slavery, but the economic benefits were too great to ignore. For nearly three decades, enslaved people passed through the island's market, their lives bought and sold like commodities. Many were sent to larger colonies. Some remained in St. Bart's, forced to work in homes, businesses, and on small farms. This dark chapter of St. Bart's history would not last forever. In 1813, under growing pressure from abolitionist movements, Sweden officially banned the transatlantic slave trade. But slavery itself remained legal on the island until 1847, when the last enslaved people were finally freed. The scars of this era lingered, a reminder that even a neutral nation was not immune to the brutal economics of colonialism. War, blockades, and the decline of Swedish street barts, 1800s. The 19th century was an age of war and revolution, and St. Bart's, once a thriving free port, soon found itself caught in the shifting tides of global conflict. The Napoleonic Wars, 1803 to 1815, upended trade across the Caribbean. British blockades cut off vital shipping routes, and St. Bart's, which had once flourished as a neutral trading post, saw its economy collapse. After Napoleon's defeat, European colonial policies shifted. The age of open trade and piracy was ending, replaced by heavily regulated commerce controlled by imperial governments. The very thing that had made street barts valuable, its status as a duty-free smuggler's paradise, was now seen as a liability by European powers. By the 1820s, Gustavia had begun to decline. Merchants left for more profitable ports. Trade slowed. The island's once bustling docks fell silent. Without a strong economic engine, Sweden struggled to justify maintaining street barts as a colony. The island's population, already small, dwindled further. Those who remained turned to fishing, salt production, and small-scale farming. But it was not enough. By the mid-19th century, it was clear Sweden's Caribbean experiment had failed. The return to France, 1878. For nearly a century, Sweden had held its small outpost in the Caribbean. But by the 1870s, the island had become a burden rather than an asset. Swedish officials, struggling to justify its upkeep, negotiated its sale back to France. The deal was finalized in 1878, and after 94 years under the Swedish flag, St. Bart's was once again a French possession. The transfer was peaceful, with little resistance from the island's inhabitants. Many were of mixed ancestry, speaking both Swedish and French Creole, yet they had long accepted that their connection to Sweden was tenuous at best. For Sweden, the loss of St. Bart's was barely a footnote. The nation had long since shifted its focus away from overseas expansion. For France, the reacquisition was more symbolic than strategic. Street Barts had little economic value compared to its larger Caribbean territories. But for St. Bart's itself, it marked the end of an era. No longer a Swedish outpost, no longer a booming free port, it was now a small, forgotten island in a world that had moved on. Yet, as history would prove, St. Bart's story was far from over. In the decades to come, the island would face economic hardship, environmental disaster, and waves of change, until, against all odds, it found a new identity in the 20th century. It would not be wealth from sugar or slavery that would define St. Bart's in the modern world. It would be luxury, exclusivity, and the rebirth of an island unlike any other. The next chapter was waiting to be written. Chapter 6, The Struggles of the 19th Century, 1800s-1900s. The return of St. Bart's to French rule in 1878 was met not with celebration, but with resignation. The island had already begun to fade from significance, slipping into the shadows of a rapidly modernizing world. Once a thriving free port under Swedish rule, now it was little more than a forgotten speck in the vast Caribbean, a place where time seemed to move slower, where the grand ambitions of empires had passed it by, leaving behind only hardship and endurance. For much of the 19th century, the people of St. Bart's fought not against invaders, nor colonial masters, but against the elements, against economic despair, and against the slow erosion of hope. The once bustling trade routes that had fueled its economy were gone. Hurricanes battered its shores. Fires reduced entire sections of Gustavia to ashes. Disease swept through the island, claiming lives without mercy. This was not an age of expansion or prosperity. This was an age of survival. The economic collapse of St. Bart's, late 1800s. With the end of Swedish rule, the island had already begun its slow economic decline. Its greatest strength, its role as a free port, was no longer relevant in a Caribbean that was now tightly controlled by European empires. In the early 19th century, St. Bart's had flourished as a hub of smuggling and tax-free trade. But by the mid to late 1800s, global commerce had changed. The end of the Napoleonic Wars, the rise of heavily policed colonial territories, and the dominance of British and French-controlled trade networks left no room for a tiny, duty-free port to thrive. Merchants left. Trade dried up. The once bustling harbor of Gustavia, where ships from all nations had once docked, now lay mostly empty. The salt flats, once a modest source of revenue, could not sustain the island alone. Those who remained behind had to find new ways to survive. Many turned to fishing, casting their nets into the same waters their ancestors had relied upon for generations. Others worked in subsistence farming, growing cassava, yams, and small crops to feed their families. But the rocky soil of St. Bart's, never fertile to begin with, could not sustain large-scale agriculture. The island, which had once been a beacon of wealth and opportunity, became one of the poorest in the Caribbean. Fire and destruction. The Gustavia fires, 1852 and 1857. If economic decline had not been enough, disaster struck. In 1852, a devastating fire swept through Gustavia, destroying homes, businesses, and warehouses that had once been filled with the goods of a thriving trade economy. With no advanced firefighting infrastructure, the flames consumed the town almost entirely, leaving charred ruins where the heart of the island had once stood. 5 years later, in 1857, a second fire erupted, undoing what little rebuilding had been accomplished since the first disaster. For many, this was the final blow. The people of St. Bart's, already struggling to survive in a failing economy, watched as their island quite literally burned around them. Many families left for St. Martin, Guadeloupe, or mainland France, hoping for better opportunities. Those who stayed behind rebuilt with whatever materials they could salvage, but Gustavia never fully recovered. Disease, death, and the hardships of isolation, 1800s-1900s. While hurricanes and fires were immediate disasters, disease was a silent and constant killer. Without modern medicine, the people of St. Bart's were vulnerable to outbreaks of yellow fever, cholera, and dysentery, diseases that swept through the Caribbean with deadly efficiency. In 1867, an outbreak of yellow fever devastated the island, killing large portions of the population. Cholera, carried by contaminated water sources, spread rapidly, striking the poorest members of society the hardest. With little access to medical care, even small infections could become deadly. The island's remoteness, once a refuge for outlaws and merchants seeking independence, now became a curse. Supplies of medicine were scarce. Doctors were few and far between. For many, death was not a matter of if, but when. By the late 1800s, St. Bart's had one of the lowest populations in its history, with many of its residents either perishing from disease or fleeing in search of better lives elsewhere. The hurricane of 1873, nature's wrath. If the fires and disease had not been enough, Mother Nature delivered yet another blow in 1873. A massive hurricane swept across the island, bringing with it torrential rains, raging winds, and a storm surge that swallowed entire sections of the coastline. The damage was catastrophic. Homes, still weak from the fires of previous decades, were obliterated. The salt ponds, one of the island's few remaining industries, were destroyed, their productivity set back for years. Ships anchored in Gustavia's harbor were ripped from their moorings and smashed against the cliffs. The islanders, already living on the brink of desperation, were left with almost nothing. For years after the storm, hunger and hardship became a daily reality. Some of the wealthier families fled permanently, leaving behind a dwindling community that now relied solely on fishing, salt collection, and the bare minimum of subsistence farming. St. Bart's had become one of the most impoverished islands in the entire Caribbean. The quietest years, 1880s, early 1900s. By the late 19th and early 20th centuries, St. Bart's had all but faded from global significance. The world had moved on. Steamships replaced sailboats, industrialized economies flourished, and colonial empires shifted their focus to larger, more profitable territories. Meanwhile, St. Bart's sat forgotten in the sea, its people surviving not through commerce, but through sheer determination. The population shrank as families continued to emigrate to Guadeloupe, St. Martin, and mainland France. The economy, once tied to global trade, was now reduced to self-sufficiency. Education was limited, and opportunities for young people were almost non-existent. It was a quiet era, an era of waiting. There were no great battles, no sweeping political movements, just the daily fight to endure. The only thing the island had left was its resilience. And in the coming century, that resilience would finally be rewarded. Because the 20th century would bring a change so profound, so unexpected, that no one on the island could have foreseen it. The age of poverty and hardship would give way to the age of exclusivity and wealth. St. Bart's would rise once more, not as a free port, not as a colonial stronghold, but as something completely different. It would become a paradise for the rich and powerful, a place where luxury and beauty masked a history of suffering. But before that transformation could take place, there were still many battles to fight, battles against hardship, against war, and against the pull of history itself. The world had yet to rediscover Street Barts. But soon it would. And the island would never be the same again. Chapter 7. St. Bart's in the 20th Century. A Forgotten Jewel. As the 19th century faded into the 20th, St. Bart's sat quietly in the Caribbean, a relic of a bygone era. The once bustling Swedish free port was long gone, swallowed by the shifting tides of history. The great colonial conflicts that had once defined the region had moved on, leaving the island behind. For the people of St. Bart's, the world had grown larger and faster, but the island itself had shrunk in importance. Steamships now dominated the Caribbean, bypassing the island in favor of larger ports. The grand trade networks of the past had been replaced by more controlled, industrialized economies. And so, as the world entered an era of modernity, St. Bart's remained locked in time, isolated, impoverished, and nearly forgotten. But time does not stand still forever. By the end of the 20th century, something remarkable would happen. St. Bart's, once a struggling outpost, would be reborn, not as a colony, nor as a trade hub, but as a paradise for the world's elite. This is the story of how Street Bart's, against all odds, found its way back into the global spotlight. A century of isolation, 1900-1940s. In the early 20th century, St. Bart's was one of the most isolated places in the Caribbean. There were no major industries, no plantations, no factories, only fishing, salt collection, and small-scale farming. The population, which had already dwindled by the late 1800s, continued to decline as younger generations left for Guadeloupe, St. Martin, or mainland France in search of work. Those who remained lived simple, self-sufficient lives, relying on the land and sea to survive. Electricity was scarce, roads were unpaved, and running water was a luxury few could afford. For the outside world, St. Bart's barely existed. The island had no economic significance, no political influence, no strategic importance. It was simply there, a quiet, forgotten place, drifting in the Caribbean like a ghost of history. But the islanders, despite their hardships, possessed something far more valuable than gold or sugar. A way of life built on resilience, simplicity, and a deep connection to their home. And as the world grew more chaotic and industrialized, it was this very way of life that would one day attract those who sought to escape modernity itself. World War II and the changing Caribbean, 1939 to 1945. When World War II erupted in 1939, the Caribbean found itself caught between the great global powers. Though the war was fought mainly in Europe and the Pacific, its impact reached even the most remote corners of the world, including Street Bart's. As a French overseas territory, St. Bart's was technically under the rule of the Vichy government after the fall of France in 1940. However, due to the island's small population and lack of strategic value, there was little direct German or Allied presence. Still, the war had indirect consequences. Trade routes were disrupted, making supplies even scarcer than before. Many young men left to join the Free French forces, leaving behind an aging population. Economic hardship deepened, forcing the islanders to rely even more on self-sufficiency. When the war finally ended in 1945, St. Bart's was left in a state of stagnation. While the world was rebuilding and modernizing, the island remained trapped in time. But change was coming, and it would arrive in the most unexpected form. The 1950s, the arrival of the first outsiders. In the 1950s, something remarkable happened. Foreigners began arriving in St. Bart's, not as colonizers, not as traders, but as visitors. Most of them were artists, writers, and adventurers, people searching for a place untouched by modern life. They came in small boats, drawn to the island's rugged beauty, its untouched beaches, and its peaceful simplicity. Among these early visitors was David Rockefeller, the American billionaire who, in the late 1950s, became enamored with street Bart's and purchased a property there. Other wealthy Europeans and Americans followed, drawn to the island's remoteness, its unspoiled charm, and the lack of large hotels or modern infrastructure. For the first time in decades, there was a new sense of curiosity about St. Bart's, a place where the ultra-rich could escape the noise and chaos of the modern world. But the true transformation was still years away. The 1960s, 1970s, a rising star among the jet set. As the world entered the 1960s and 1970s, travel became more accessible than ever before. The rise of commercial aviation meant that even remote islands like Street Bart's were no longer out of reach. At first, the island's tourism industry was humble, a few goose houses, small beachside cottages, and family-run inns. There were no massive resorts, no luxury villas, no high-end boutiques. But then, the European and American elite began to take notice. Suddenly, royalty, Hollywood actors, fashion icons, and business moguls were arriving, seeking refuge in the island's untouched paradise. Unlike the more commercialized Caribbean destinations, St. Bart's offered something rare: privacy, exclusivity, seclusion. By the 1970s, St. Bart's had earned a reputation as a hidden escape for the world's most powerful and influential figures. But with this attention came a new challenge. How could Street Bart's maintain its authenticity while welcoming wealth and development? The 1980s, the birth of luxury Street Bart's. In the 1980s, St. Bart's underwent its biggest transformation yet. Luxury hotels began to appear, small, elegant, and designed to blend with the island's natural beauty. Hotel Eden Rock, originally a simple guest house, became an icon of elite hospitality. Lou Sereno and Lou Toyney followed, catering to the world's wealthiest travelers. Private villas, once small family homes, were renovated into multi-million dollar estates. The runway at Gustav III Airport was expanded, allowing small jets to land. Suddenly, the island was more accessible to those who could afford it. With this new influx of wealth, high-end restaurants, designer boutiques, and luxury services emerged. St. Bart's was no longer just a remote island. It had become the ultimate Caribbean playground for the elite. But beneath the glamour and exclusivity, the island still held on to its humble roots. Unlike other Caribbean luxury destinations, St. Bart's maintained its low-rise architecture, local culture, and strict environmental regulations, preventing overdevelopment. This balance between luxury and authenticity would define the island for decades to come. A new identity, a new era. As the 20th century drew to a close, St. Bart's was no longer a forgotten jewel. It had been rediscovered, redefined, and reborn. No longer a struggling colonial outpost. No longer an abandoned freeport. No longer a place left behind by history. St. Bart's was now a symbol of luxury, exclusivity, and escape. But even as the island embraced its newfound status, one question remained. Could it hold on to its soul while catering to the world's elite? The 21st century would answer that question. And the next chapter in St. Bart's story was just beginning. Chapter 8, The Birth of the Luxury Paradise, 1950s, 1970s. For centuries, St. Bart's was a place of struggle, an island that had seen the rise and fall of empires, endured hurricanes, fires, disease, and economic despair. By the mid-20th century, it was a forgotten land, a place where time seemed to stand still. The world had changed. War had reshaped continents, technology had transformed cities, and wealth was being redefined. Yet St. Bart's remained much as it had always been, a quiet, isolated island where life moved at the pace of the tides. Then, something remarkable happened. By the 1950s, a new kind of traveler arrived, not conquerors, not merchants, not colonists, but wealthy visionaries, artists, and adventurers, drawn by the very things that had once made the island undesirable: its remoteness, its simplicity, its unspoiled beauty. These were the pioneers of St. Bart's rebirth, the first whispers of what the island would become. Not just a tropical escape, but the most exclusive and luxurious destination in the world. The 1950s, a quiet discovery. For most of the early 20th century, the Caribbean was dominated by large, bustling ports and tourist-friendly islands like Puerto Rico, the Bahamas, and Jamaica. These destinations catered to mass tourism, welcoming cruise ships, big hotels, and sprawling resorts. St. Bart's, by contrast, was off the map, too small, too rugged, too difficult to reach. There were no airports, no luxury resorts, no major industries. Yet, this very isolation became its greatest asset. By the 1950s, a handful of European aristocrats and American elites, tired of the growing commercialization of places like the French Riviera, began seeking a new kind of paradise. They wanted privacy. They wanted something untouched, unspoiled, and unlike anywhere else in the world. Among the first to truly recognize street BART's potential was David Rockefeller. David Rockefeller's arrival, a turning point, 1957. In 1957, David Rockefeller, the billionaire philanthropist and grandson of oil magnate John D. Rockefeller, arrived in St. Bart's. At the time, the island was still a humble fishing community, with no major infrastructure, no paved roads, and very few modern conveniences. Yet, Rockefeller saw something extraordinary. The untouched beaches, the rolling green hills, the quiet solitude of the island. All of it reminded him of the Mediterranean before it had been overrun by tourism. Determined to make Street Bart's his personal retreat, he purchased large sections of land on the island. But unlike many other wealthy landowners, he did not seek to build sprawling resorts or gated estates. Instead, he worked to preserve the island's natural beauty, constructing an elegant yet modest villa that blended into the landscape. His presence alone was enough to spark interest from others in the elite circles of finance, art, and fashion. The idea of St. Bart's as a hidden paradise for the ultra-wealthy was beginning to take shape. The 1960s, a playground for the jet set. By the 1960s, St. Bart's had begun to attract an exclusive group of travelers: European royalty, American billionaires, and fashion icons. The island's allure was simple. It was untouched, private, and exclusive. There were no crowds. There were no commercial resorts. There were no flashing cameras or invasive media. In an era when celebrities and the ultra-rich were constantly pursued by journalists and paparazzi, St. Bart's became a rare refuge, a place where the world's most powerful people could disappear. This decade saw the arrival of some of the first small luxury accommodations, catering to this elite clientele. Eden Rock, a simple guest house turned luxury retreat, perched dramatically on a rocky promontory in St. Jean Bay. Boutique villas, modest, privately owned residences that were slowly transformed into exclusive rental properties for the wealthy. Unlike other Caribbean islands, St. Bart's never embraced mass tourism. Instead, it built its reputation on exclusivity, a place that was accessible only to those who could afford its seclusion. The 1970s, the rise of St. Bart's signature luxury culture. By the 1970s, St. Bart's had become a magnet for the world's elite. With its pristine beaches, charming French Caribbean culture, and strict low-density development policies, the island began to solidify its identity as a luxury retreat rather than a tourist hotspot. Several key factors accelerated this transformation. 1. The emergence of celebrity tourism. By the mid-1970s, St. Bart's had become the playground of choice for some of the most famous figures of the era. French film stars, including Brigitte Bardot, found solace in the island's bohemian charm. New York socialites and Wall Street moguls began purchasing private villas along the coast. Fashion designers and artists saw in St. Bart's what the French Riviera had once been, an untouched sanctuary of beauty and inspiration. 2. The influence of the French government. When Street Bart's was reintegrated into France as an overseas territory, it benefited from French government policies that preserved its local character, while ensuring continued investment in infrastructure. Unlike other Caribbean islands, which were being flooded with large resorts and high-rise hotels, St. Bart's remained small-scale, intimate, and deliberately underdeveloped. 3. The expansion of Gustave III Airport, 1972. Perhaps the most significant change in the 1970s was the expansion of Gustave III Airport, allowing small private jets to land directly on the island. Before this, visiting Street Bart's was a logistical challenge, requiring a boat transfer from nearby islands. But with the new airport, the world's wealthiest individuals could arrive directly in their private aircraft, further cementing Street Bart's reputation as a sanctuary for the elite. With easier access came a surge in high-end real estate investment, as luxury villas, five-star boutique hotels, and Michelin-starred restaurants began appearing on the island. St. Bart's was no longer just a hidden gem. It was now the most exclusive destination in the Caribbean. A new identity, Street Bart's as the ultimate luxury destination. By the end of the 1970s, the transformation was complete. The island had gone from an abandoned outpost to a global icon of luxury and refinement. St. Bart's was no longer just another Caribbean island. It had become something entirely different. A haven for billionaires and celebrities. A place where privacy and exclusivity mattered more than commercialism. A destination where luxury meant simplicity, elegance, and seclusion, rather than excess. But with this transformation came new challenges. Could Street Bart's remain true to its soul while catering to the world's elite? The 1980s and 1990s would bring new waves of investment, fame, and cultural shifts, testing the island's ability to preserve its identity while embracing the growing demand for luxury tourism. Would Street Bart's hold on to its authenticity? Or would it succumb to the fate of other overdeveloped tourist destinations? The next chapter would answer that question. And the story of St. Bart's was far from over.